Our reading focuses on the painful, difficult, heartbreaking relationship between King David and his son Absalom. But before we read the story, you need to know a little bit about what's happening, a little context. To be blunt, King David's family was an absolute mess. Now, the main storyline you need to know concerns what happened between two of David's sons. He had other sons, but this story focuses on two. Focuses on Amnon, his oldest son, and Absalom, okay, a younger son. Now, David had several wives and other mistresses. Leave that aside for now. These two sons, Amnon and Absalom, were from different mothers, so they were half-brothers. The younger son, Absalom, had a full sister, same mother, named Tamar. Tamar happened to be beautiful, okay? Now, Amnon, David's oldest son, wanted to have his half-sister, Tamar. And so he cooked up a deceitful plan. He pretended to be ill, and then he asked his father, King David, if he would send him his half-sister, Tamar, to care for him, to be his nurse. That's the plan. So when Tamar comes into Amnon's bedroom, he first tries to seduce her, and then when she wouldn't sleep with him, he raped her. After that terrible deed, instead of restoring her honor by going ahead and marrying her, which would have been possible in that ancient culture, he doesn't do that. Amnon actually casts her aside in disgust, sort of doubling down on the deed. Now, Absalom, who's Tamar's full brother, remember, was furious, of course, when he finds out what his older half-brother Amnon had done to his sister Tamar. So Absalom takes his sister Tamar into his household to protect her. He demanded that his father, King David, take action, act decisively against Amnon and what Amnon has done to Tamar. But David, for reasons we can't fully understand and we're not told, David doesn't act. He refused to act. He went passive. He neglected to do anything about the situation. And so Absalom's hatred grew, both for his half-brother Amnon, who had raped his sister, and for his father, King David, who refused to hold Amnon accountable. Okay? Now, fast forward a few years. I think it's about 3 years later. Now it's Absalom who will trick and deceive his father, King David. So Absalom asks his father, the king, to send all of his various sons to him. He wants to celebrate a festival, and he wants all of his brothers there. David falls for the trick. All the sons go to Absalom's property. And when Amnon arrived, Absalom murdered him in revenge and then flees the country. Okay? So King David mourns for years. He mourned for his son Amnon, who'd been murdered, of course, but he also mourned for his son Absalom, who had fled the country, was in exile, and he wanted Absalom to come back home. Absalom eventually returns home. He receives forgiveness from David. He's even restored to the king's palace, so he gets his security clearance. Everything is okay. He's back in the mix and fully forgiven. But immediately, Absalom begins making plans to overthrow his father, King David, to remove him by military coup. So he goes around winning the military to his side to stage a revolt, to depose David as a king and to make himself king. So there's all-out civil war in Israel. Those who remain loyal to David fighting against the armies of Israel who align themselves with David's son, Absalom. Okay, so all that, that's a lot, right? All that's going on. But you need to know that in order to hear today's story. David sending out his own military troops against the rebel armies who are led by his own son, Absalom. Now to the reading from 2 Samuel 18. The king commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, "Be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake." And all the troops heard the king giving orders concerning Absalom to each of the commanders. David's army marched out of the city to fight Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. There Israel's troops were routed by David's men, and the casualties that day were very great, 20,000 men. The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and the forest swallowed up more men that day than the sword. Now, Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's hair got caught in the tree. He was left hanging in midair, other translations, hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule he was riding on kept going. When one of the men saw what had happened, he told Joab, the military commander, "I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree." Joab said to the man who had told him this, "What? You saw him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground right there? Then I would have had to give you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt." But the man replied, "Even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out into my hands, I would not lay a hand on the king's son. In our very hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, protect the young man Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy and nothing is hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me." Joab said, "Blah, blah, blah, blah. I have no time to wait on this for you." So he took 3 javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. And 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him and killed him, finished him off. So then a messenger goes back to David with the news. Then the Cushite arrived back to David and said, "My lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has vindicated you today by delivering you from the hand of all who rose up against you." But the king asked the Cushite, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" The Cushite replied, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man." The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." This story is beautifully and carefully scripted. It's written in a way that draws our attention to the difficult knot that exists in the relationship between this particular father, King David, and his son Absalom. It's tragic, it's anguished, it's complex, it's dark, but we need artfully told stories like this. We need deeply true stories that usher us into a realm where we can find some fresh, new approach to the difficulty, pain, and heartbreak of our lives. There is no way to avoid saying it. This story calls us out away from the shallow shores and into the deep mystery of our lives, lived with one another and with God. Now, we don't need a sermon that life is hard, right? We all already know that. Life is difficult. And there are several different things that make our lives hard. Let me just mention a few, okay? First of all, our lives require us to be continually responding to stuff that we don't control, right? Stuff comes our way, it happens to us, there's nothing we could have done about it. We face a health challenge, we lose a loved one, we lose a job, we struggle financially, we experience failure in some relationship or some life project that was meaningful and important to us. That's stuff that comes at us and we have to cope with it, right? We didn't control that. Secondly, our lives can be difficult because we bring it on ourselves, right? We sow seeds that sort of boomerang back and cause us trouble. We fail to plan. We take shortcuts. We lack courage. We betray our own values and harm the people that we love, right? We know that. Third, life can be difficult because it's just full of tension and temptation, where we face this conflict between good and evil. We know the kind of life we want to live. We know the people we want to be, but yet we're pulled in other directions, and that's difficult sometimes, okay? But none of those difficulties name the tragic sort of view of life that you find in the story we read today. Sometimes we face difficulties in which we want 2 different things, but we can't have them both, right? Now think about that for a minute. That's even harder. We want 2 things, but they're mutually exclusive, and we can't have them both. That's where David is. King David wants 2 things. He wants, first of all, to quell the revolt and keep his throne, right? But he also wants to keep his son Absalom alive. He wants 2 things, but he won't be able to have them both. Our reading begins with King David giving instructions to his military commanders. He says, quote, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom, verse 5. Here's a powerful king sending out his military men with a mission of putting down a rebellion. So let there be no doubt, his military commanders are to go out and to kill mercilessly if need be, in order to defend the king's regime. That's their job. But the king asks for something that will be difficult, if not impossible, in this wartime situation. He asks his men to deal gently with Absalom. Now, what on earth does that mean? And what do you suppose they heard when he asked them to deal gently with Absalom? They are to deal gently with Absalom, not because he deserves it so much, says David. They are to do so for David's sake. Do so for my sake. Perhaps the king is a little embarrassed about even making this request of his military commanders. It seems like David's trying to downplay the fact that he's a father who's afraid of losing his son. That's why he doesn't refer to Absalom as my son. Rather, Absalom is simply the young man. Deal gently with the young man, Absalom, for my sake. This story is artfully told. It kind of unfolds like a tightly edited movie script. So some of the facts and details just flash by very quickly. We know that David's side wins. We know that the battle was bloody. We're told that 20,000 men lost their lives that day. We're told that the forest, quote, swallowed up more men than the sword, that's an odd detail, right? But that, the forest swallowing people up, that's cues us in and gets us ready for the very next important scene. Because this tale is primarily about what happens to Absalom in the forest. And here the camera lingers a little longer, the action slows down, the pace slows, so that we can see what happens. Absalom, who is known from previous parts of the story as being extremely good looking and having long flowing hair, right? We're told that earlier. Absalom with long hair is riding his mule through the forest. His hair gets caught in an oak tree, but the mule keeps going. And there's Absalom, both the hated rebel, right? And the king's beloved dear son, hanging in midair. That's what's printed in your liturgies from today's New International Version, hanging in midair. That's a rather bland translation, actually. So the New Revised Standard Version is much better, expressing literally what the Hebrew phrase says. And literally it says, Absalom is left, quote, hanging between heaven and earth. Now that's interesting. Hanging between heaven and earth. It's quite a poetic way to describe Absalom's conundrum. And I think it invites us to reflect on our own lives. Perhaps it's not just Absalom, but all of us who are hanging between heaven and earth. For much of our lives, we're caught in various kinds of conflict and division and tension. We're hung up between living into the fullness of life that God wants for us in Jesus Christ, and on the other hand, living far beneath that life. We're caught between hope and despair. We're caught between love and hate, between kindness and coldness. Our lives are often divided between wanting close relationships with other people and then wanting freedom from other people's expectations. We want familiarity and we want newness. We want to travel and we want to see everything and we want to stay put and stay home. So here's Absalom hanging between heaven and earth. Here's a human being whose life could have moved in several directions. He was the king's beloved son, but he was also the rebel and an enemy of the king. And King David's life was framed by these same contradictions. He too was capable of greatness. He was a man after God's own heart, we're told. And at the same time, David was a man of uncontrolled appetites, a lover of power and success, and a neglecting, inattentive father. So how do we avoid the conclusion that we too hang between heaven and earth? A woman who works as a counselor, as a therapist, spoke about the particular challenge she has of counseling people who have lots of money. This woman works as a therapist in New York City, and so it just so happens that a number of her clients are very, very rich. And she was talking about how this poses a problem to her in her work. She began to hear from a number of her clients. She heard them using a phrase she had never heard before. Her clients were speaking about their desire for a, quote, turnkey life. A turnkey life. She said she'd never heard this phrase before, and she didn't know what they meant when they used it. So she began asking them, what do you mean by having a turnkey life? And what she found out when she asked them was that they believed that money can solve all of life's problems. It should be able to solve all of life's problems. If you have enough money, you can fix anything. That's what they believed. You can use your wealth to secure the kind of life where there's no agony, there's no struggle, you don't need to have any patience, you don't need to wait on stuff, there's no process that you have to endure and be patient through. If you have enough money, everything can be exactly how you want it, and right now, a turnkey life. Now, I don't think there's very many of us in this room who are wealthy enough to be in danger of that particular kind of desire for a turnkey life, but I do think that we can identify with what's going on with them, right? I mean, I get that. I'd love to have the kind of life where I could just avoid, do a runaround, any kind of pain or struggle or waiting for what I want. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a life that wasn't pockmarked by disappointment, by failure, by grief, rage, resentment, depression, and confusion? Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we just craft our lives exactly as we wanted them? If we could just make plans for what we want to unfold for us and no one would get in the way, no friction, everything would go just like we wanted it to? Wouldn't it be nice if all our desires, just everything lined up nicely and ran in the same direction? The writer David Shields has a book entitled, you'll go. The title is, The Thing About Life Is That One Day You'll Be Dead. The thing about life is that one day you'll be dead. It's not an inspiring title, but it's actually a good book. It's a memoir written by David Shields. He's just turned 51, so he's feeling old. But his father is 97 and as vibrant as ever. And this bugs the heck out of him, and so this is part of his memoir. Shields says that his life mission is to just keep saying to himself, I need to learn to accept death. Death is coming. I need to accept. I'm mortal. Can't last forever. And he says his father's motto was just the reverse. Accept life. Live it to the full, right? And his dad's 97. So this annoys him. Shields talks about the fact that at some point in life, and maybe this point is different for all of us, but at some point in life, you realize, quote, that you're switching from saying hi to saying goodbye. And Shields says he's there. He talks about he was an athlete when he was young. He's got terrible lower back problems, so he can't play sports anymore. You know, so his back trouble and his former life as an athlete communicates to him that he's clearly on the downhill side, frustrating to him. His father, his 97-year-old father, by contrast, is, quote, maddeningly alive and interesting, exhausting and exhaustive. While thinking more and more about his own approaching death, Shields finds his father, quote, more alive than anyone else. I seem to have an urge to bury him, Shields writes. I don't know if his father read his book, but anyway. Why do I want to cover my dad in an early shroud, he asks. And then there comes this next curious, intriguing, wonderful sentence, quote. Shields speaking about his dad. He's strong and he's weak, and I love him and I hate him, and I want him to live forever, and I want him to die tomorrow. It takes a good writer and a good story to help us express the complexity of our relationships with other people, especially the people who are close to us. It's quite possible, and I think likely even, to love those we hate sometimes and to hate those we love sometimes. We desperately need to be loved, want to be loved by those nearest to us. And we tend to hate them when they fail to deliver what we think we need. I once had a conversation with a neighbor. We didn't know each other all that well. It was a kind of, you know, We weren't close. I found out that his father had passed away, and so, you know, just out in the yard, I said, I'm sorry about that. He proceeded to tell me that his father was a worthless bleepity bleep, that he was glad he was dead. I haven't talked to him in 6 months, he said. And the last time I saw him, we had an argument, and the last thing I said to my dad before he died was, bleep you. So, you know, these are harsh words to hear, uncomfortable, awkward for me, but I noticed that he was crying when he said these things. Life is extremely complex. When David's men find the rebel Absalom suspended from the oak tree, there's a brief discussion, a very brief discussion, about David's request for them to deal gently with Absalom. But Joab isn't interested in that conversation. He drives 3 spears through the body of Absalom and then orders his troops to finish him off and bury him as a traitor. When the messenger reached King David with news of military victory, David only wanted to know about Absalom. And when he learns that Absalom has died, he's no longer the victorious king, but now only a heartbroken father. Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. So if Israel's greatest king was not kept from soul-rending heartbreak, who are we to think that we can skate through life without any significant wounds? Our need for love is complicated, and yet this story of David and Absalom invites us to offer ourselves afresh to the living God, asking for the light of God's grace to illumine all the various knots in our own lives. I doubt God's grace will fix everything, sorry. But I do find it good news that we are loved by the kind of God who will come and be with us in the middle of it all, even if we can't fully figure ourselves out. The living Christ invites us to follow him, to become his friends, and to share in his life. And we dilly-dally and delay, making excuses. We don't quite have our act together yet, but he's already moving along out in front of us, expecting us to scurry along too, leaving all of our excuses behind. This story refuses to be tidied up. There's no inspiring moral at the end. It's about grief and unresolvable pain, about heartache that won't ever fully go away. We can encourage one another to listen for God's voice speaking to us in the midst of all this confusion, grief, and pain, but we'll have to listen for God even if God doesn't sort everything out in the end. There is a kind of hope in God that doesn't bargain for magic solutions. There's a way of trusting God that doesn't pray for some kind of miraculous escape, but instead simply pleads with God to come, come and be near us in the mess of all our pain and regret. Amen.